Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. It took only 81 minutes for $500 million worth of art to vanish. And 35 years later, the case remains unsolved, and the artwork is still missing. Art theft is not just a plot used in Hollywood movies. It's a real concern for the art world, and a lucrative black market for others. Art heists occur more often than you may think. And while they don't necessarily involve tiptoeing around a field of lasers or stealing the Declaration of Independence, they are interesting in how they are pulled off and where the art goes. Joining us is Aaron Thompson, an author and art crime professor at the City University of New York. Welcome to All Sides, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
So art theft can occur in many forms. Most people would think of stealing from museums when they hear the words art theft, I would think. But what are some other forms of art theft that people might not even realize is art theft?
Sure. Well, stealing from museums is not such a great idea because as soon as you try and sell something, the dealer or the collector is going to think, that looks a little familiar, and then you're in trouble. But there's all sorts of fraud and forgery and theft that takes place in the art world because it's based on trust. So if you walk into a gallery, someone takes you to the back room and says, oh, I have this great bargain on this painting. You don't necessarily think to check, does this really belong to you, the dealer? Have you already sold it to somebody else and are trying to get more money out of me? And the same thing with other transactions. You can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on eBay, and people have, to buy something that turns out to be a photocopy or a painting that isn't really what they said. So all sorts of opportunities to make money in very naughty ways in the art world.
Yeah. Now, is art theft from museums, you know, the typical way you would think of, you know, from the Hollywood movies, is it a common thing?
It happens, but the people who get away with it, who actually make money from stealing money from or art from museums, are stealing from storage. That's pretty smart because it's really difficult to know when something goes missing. But it's pretty obvious when a piece comes off the wall of a museum. What we find is that people who steal from museums are mostly people who are good at stealing, but not too good at thinking through what they're going to do with the object after they take it. So they know art is valuable. They think they'll figure it out. The Atlantic recently had a great story by the journalist Ariel Sabar, who profiled a man who was just convicted of multiple museum thefts. What he would do after his first theft, he stole some artwork and discovered he couldn't sell it. So then he realized museums are a good target. They don't have such great security. So he stole things like Yogi Berra's World Series rings and other collectibles, other things made out of precious material. And he just melted them down in a garage crucible and sold them for the price of the stones or the metal.
Oh, wow. So he destroyed this artifact from the Yogi Berra era to just sell it for the metal?
Yes. And then very sweetly, Yogi Berra said, well, you know, I remember I won the World Series, so I don't really need them.
Oh, man. Okay. So, yeah. So art theft is not just stealing a painting off the wall. I mean, it can be something like that, a piece of memorabilia. Is that that's art-ish as well?
Definitely. I mean, museums have valuable stuff of all sorts. And where else really are you able to get so close to something that could be selling for millions of dollars? You don't get to walk into Fort Knox and get your nose a couple inches away from a gold bar, but you can get very, very close to beautiful artworks that are made of precious materials or that are just famous for their artists. So, and also, as I said, museums are often in historical buildings that can't really be outfitted to be as secure as a modern building, or they just don't have the money to pay for the highest tech security systems. Nobody has lasers, sorry to say.
That's only in the movies? Okay.
Only in the movies. Because think about it, museums, especially in the US, rely on donors, and people want to donate to buy a new Rembrandt. They don't want to donate to upgrade the tapes in the security system or something like that. So it's pretty easy to take, but very hard to profit from theft from a museum.
So Tell me about the security and the technology. I mean, I'm sure it's more advanced than it was in the past, but is it as simple as just alarms on doors and video security?
That's pretty much it. Most museums make it difficult to exit the building rapidly. So if you go to a museum next time, you'll notice that there are emergency exits, sure, in case of a fire, but there's really only a few entry and exit points, and those have guards stationed there to make sure that somebody isn't rushing out with something bulky under their coat. But that can be defeated as well. So in a theft in the Worcester Art Museum, many decades ago, but still one of my favorites, because the thieves just dressed in matching t-shirts and then picked a painting off the wall and walked out of the museum, and people assumed they were art movers. So they got almost all the way out until a guard started yelling at them, not because they were stealing a painting, but because they were walking on an ancient mosaic in the lobby of the building. And if they had only gone around it, they would have gotten away.
So if you look the part, like you belong moving a painting, then you can get away with it sometimes. In that case, they almost did.
Exactly. And then in other cases, the security system was pretty thorough, but it was a little too thorough. So there was a huge theft in a museum in Paris a few years ago, where it was astounding at first because the museum had just received a new security system. But then it turned out that it was a little buggy, so the motion sensors kept going off all the time. And the guards got so sick of checking on them for it to be nothing that they just switched off the security system. And then somebody, whether he figured this out or not, whether he knew it in advance or not, it's unclear, but he climbed up to the roof, broke in through a skylight, and did in fact dangle down into the museum and steal a bunch of paintings.
Oh, so okay. So there's no lasers, but dangling down from the ceiling does actually happen in real life.
At least in this case.
Okay. Where was that? Do you remember?
This is the Palais de Tokyo in Paris, a contemporary and modern art museum.
Okay. So someone broke the ceiling, dangled down, and because the motion sensors were off, they were able to just like snatch something, and then someone was on the roof to pull them back up.
Yeah, they actually took multiple paintings. They were there for an hour or so.
Oh, wow.
There's no security.
Great. So when thieves do steal from museums, do they steal anything they can get their hands on, or is it kind of just like a target of opportunity, what happens to be next to each other?
That is really depends on the thief. So there are a very few cases where thieves are stealing for themselves to form a collection. There's a great nonfiction book that just came out last year called The Art Thief by Michael Finkel, who profiles Stefan Breitbeiser, who loved art, did not have a lot of money, and so just sort of helped himself to the contents of various small museums in Switzerland and France. And in that case, he really did want certain things. But he would also look for opportunities where the case wasn't attached so firmly so he could move it in. There's one instance where he wanted to steal a piece of decorative silver from a museum in Brussels in a case full of them. So he not only undid the case, the display case, took the object he wanted, and took the display card too, so it wouldn't be noticed, but he rearranged the rest of the case so that it wouldn't look like anything was missing. And then that went well, so he kept coming back a couple more times until he had basically emptied out the case without anyone noticing. But in a lot of cases, it does seem to be a kind of smash and grab endeavor. But you know, I love museums, so I think everything in there is great. it's hard to go wrong in a lot of museums.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about art theft with Aaron Thompson, an author and an art crime professor at the City University of New York. So there was a very famous heist, very infamous as well, that recently had its 35-year anniversary, the Isabella Stewart Gardner heist in Boston, where two men dressed as police officers entered into the museum, and within 81 minutes, they left with $500 million worth of art. Now, is it true they still have not solved this? They have not found any of this art?
Correct.
I mean, that's so you're saying that the people who stole this $500 million worth of art from in Boston, they must not have tried to sell it anywhere because no one has picked up on that. Do you think it's just hanging, whoever stole it, it's all hanging in their house somewhere?
Well, there are several theories because it's true. These were very recognizable paintings in themselves in one of the most famous museums in the US. And then the news of the crime hit the papers immediately. So it no one has said, oh, these people tried to sell these objects to me. So it doesn't seem like they tried to sell them. But what happens when artwork is stolen from a museum and doesn't reappear? Well, sometimes, very, very rarely though, it's when someone wants it for themselves. But I doubt this was the case because in those cases where it's a sort of kleptomaniac collector, if there's more than one thief, they're in a relationship with one another. And so if there's these two guys who don't seem to be in a relationship, I find it hard to think that they wouldn't have fallen out at some point and reported each other. What else happens? Well, people wake up, they see the papers, they start to reconsider the wisdom of their plan of stealing stuff, and often they will turn the artworks in to take the heat off. They'll call up the police and say, oh, hey, go to this church or this bus stop or something and open the bag and you'll find the artworks. And that happens a lot. Very sadly, the other impulse is to avoid prosecution, avoid being caught by destroying the artworks. So in the Breitfeiser case I just mentioned, once he was arrested, his mother destroyed hundreds of pieces that he had stolen. She threw some of them into a canal. She burned others. She chopped others up because she wanted to prevent the police from seizing them. In Europe, sometimes you find museums are targeted by people who don't really intend on selling the objects. They want to ransom them. In Europe, many museums have insurance policies that will give more or less a 10% reward for return, no questions asked, for stolen art. So you can steal something, then you can, if you need money down the road, send your girlfriend to the police with a painting and say, hey, give me the, you know, $1 million for this $10 million painting. There are definite difficulties in that plan. The police will still vigorously try and investigate. But I don't think that's the case for the Gardner Museum because they didn't have that type of insurance. What I think, and prepare yourself for being depressed, is that whoever stole these artworks from the Gardner Museum woke up, saw the papers, thought, oh no, I gotta either destroy them or hide them. And they've been buried in somebody's backyard or in somebody's attic for 35 years. And you can't do that to a Rembrandt without it being eaten by bugs or consumed by mold or otherwise decaying. So I, again, depressingly, sorry, think that these artworks are gone.
Yeah. So let's back up a second. So this heist with the $500 million worth of art from the Gardner Museum, they didn't take the frames off the walls. They cut them out. Can you explain that?
Well, it's harder to carry a frame out of it. These are giant paintings. If you go to the Gardner Museum today, they still have the frames up on the wall to sort of mourn the theft. And you can see there, many of them are just enormous. So if you cut the canvas out, you can roll it up and take it with you more easily. This detail has been of interest to a lot of people who have said, well, obviously these weren't art connoisseurs because no one could bring themselves to do that to Rembrandt if they truly loved art. But I don't really know what to make of it.
Okay. And so no one knows who these people are. Is there video of them? Did they have I was reading about it. They tied up there's one security guard and that was it.
There's some surveillance footage of the car on the street outside, but it's very grainy. You know, it's 35 years ago. It's not that great. This poor security guard, he was pretty new on the job. He was a student at the Berklee School of Music. So he just answered the door because someone rang and said, "Hey, I'm a police officer here to investigate a theft." And he opened the door, and then that was it. He was duct taped to his chair and left there to stew while they went and cut art off the wall.
Okay. Now, I did read on the website of the museum, not only do they have the empty frames there in homage of the missing artwork, but then they also have quite a hefty reward for any information. Has that reward always been there? And can you tell us about it? I guess they probably get empty tips, but nothing's ever come of it.
There have been a number of claimed sightings of the paintings. There was a reporter who was taken to see one of them, but only got a glimpse of it in a dark room for a second. There have been people who've sent in photographs next to the today's paper, to prove that they're real. But in several of those cases, the heavy suspicion is that that was just a copy of the painting or an enlarged photograph or something like that, made by someone who is trying to collect the reward. So nothing has come of that. But there have been other cases when art stolen from museum has indeed been found thanks to a reward, or a reward has been offered and entrapped the thief into coming forward. That was the case, for example, for Edvard Munch's The Scream, the painting, which was stolen from a museum in Norway by someone who took a little construction ladder from a site next door and climbed up, broke a window, yanked it out, and then left behind a postcard on which was written, "Thanks for the bad security."
Oh, clever. Okay. So that was the original The Scream painting, and what happened to it? This person stole used a ladder, stole it, and then what happened?
So it was actually someone who had stolen another Munch painting previously. I guess he just you pop one, he can't stop with the stolen Munch paintings. And so that just the painting disappeared for a while until an investigator with the British police, with Scotland Yard, worked with the Getty to adopt an undercover persona as a Getty curator who was going to pay a reward for the return of this painting with the idea that the Getty could exhibit it. So that was why he had the money. And this actually worked. He seized the painting, the police arrested the thief, but then it turns out that under the Norwegian law, you can't impersonate someone in this way that violates the rights of the person arrested. So he actually didn't get punished for stealing this painting.
Oh no, you got out on a technicality. Great. All right. We are talking about art theft with Aaron Thompson, author and art crime professor at the City University of New York. We're going to continue our conversation after the break. We're going to talk more about trying to track down stolen art when we continue. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
World War II was incredibly large of event for theft. Some people estimate that as much as a third of the artwork in Europe was moved because of Nazi looting. But on a lesser scale, this happens all of the time. Not just for the love of art, but because taking people's cultural property is a really effective technique for demoralizing them or for breaking their bonds with a certain place and causing them to flee. So, a few years ago, when the Islamic State was at war in Syria and Iraq, one of their most effective techniques was not just to destroy cultural sites, churches, shrines, mosques, ancient sites, but to announce that they were going to do it. That would be the first thing they would do when they came into a new location. And then they would do it and people would think, oh, if they blew up this site, I'm going to be next. And they would flee. And that was one of the reasons why there was such a wave of refugees from Syria that spread around the world. And that meant the Islamic State fighters, they didn't have to go house by house, street by street. They could just destroy people's spirits and links with their home and send them into the world. And just today, actually, are breaking news stories, reports of the devastation of the Sudanese National Museum in its ongoing conflict. So, and in Ukraine, museums have been looted and bombed. It's an ongoing problem. And I think more people need to think when they're buying artworks, when they're buying antiquities, is this something that came out of a conflict rather than thinking, oh, this is a beautiful thing. I want to have it on my mantelpiece.
Yeah, I did want to talk about that for a minute, about the idea of how do you know where a piece of art is from? So, I mean, there's plenty of people out there who just love and are very interested in gorgeous works. But how do you know if what you're buying is authentic or if it's been stolen?
It is difficult, but it's doable. And essentially, you have to ask questions and you can't trust the answers. So if you walk into a gallery, they're going to say something like, oh, well, it came from a notable London collection. And I can't really tell you. We keep the name of the seller anonymous. And you have to say, that's not going to work for me. There are cases in which dealers have faked the paperwork, have even faked old collection labels and stained them with tea to make it look like some piece that was actually just looted from Egypt had been in a British private collection for 100 years. So you can trust, but you've got to verify by finding independent sources that show you that this antiquity has really been out of its country of origin for as long as the dealer might claim. And the same thing with works of art. So many works passed through Nazi hands and can be claimed back by the families who lost them. So you don't want to buy a lawsuit. You don't want to buy a repatriation claim. And if you're going to spend money on art, you need to make sure that you know exactly where it's been for as long as possible.
Are there instances of museums have being duped too, where they acquire a piece of artwork and then find out that they that it was not authentic or was not hands, it was not transferred hands in the correct way?
Oh, definitely. The Cleveland Museum of Art just recently surrendered a bronze statue to Turkey that had been looted in the 1970s from a site called Buban, and it was a whole imperial shrine. The Romans set up these life-size statues of emperors, and the shrine was looted. And then suddenly all of these gorgeous life-size bronze statues of emperors start appearing on the market in the US at the same time. And everyone thought, that seems suspicious, because all of the countries they could have come from had long banned the export of that type of antiquity. So it wasn't very plausible that these had been out of the country of origin for 100 plus years without anybody ever publishing them or taking photographs of them and noticing them. But still, people came up with explanations of where they had been, and museums, including the Metropolitan Museum and the Cleveland Museum of Art, eventually acquired some of them. Then in the last year, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office did more research, talked to some of the looters, figured out the path that these objects had taken and succeeded in claiming them back to give them to Turkey. And fakes, oh yes, plenty of museums have also been fooled by fakes, and those are also delightful stories.
Yeah, why don't you, we're running out of time, but can you tell us a story of a museum being duped by a fake?
Well, it's hard to choose. I'm writing a book right now on the forgeries of antiquities, so I have so many. For example, the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., just a few years ago, had to admit that all of the fragments of Dead Sea Scrolls that it had acquired, for which donors paid millions and millions of dollars, that they all were fake. And it turns out that a number of collectors and institutions had ended up with these fake fragments that were supposed to support the accuracy of the Bible, but instead had been, someone had taken an old leather shoe from ancient Egypt, it seems, and scribbled some text copied from modern editions of the Hebrew Bible on it. And then sold them for up to $500,000 a piece. So I think a creative use of old shoes, but shows that even museums need to keep asking a lot of questions instead of trusting what sellers say.
You mentioned that you're working on a book about art forgery. Can you tell us about that book? What kind of stories are you telling?
So yeah, I'm looking at how people have gotten away with faking the past and what motivations they have, what scientific tests can or cannot tell us, what you can get out of going to courts, and the motivations of buyers as well. So stories, everything from someone who was digging up genuine Native American burial mounds in Michigan in the turn of the century to plant fake artifacts that supposedly were the proving that Noah's Ark was launched from America, among other things.
Someone buried artifacts to...
Yes, and destroyed actual burials to do so in the 19-teens. There's a court case I'm following right now where a Qatari sheikh is suing a New York City antiquities gallery for selling what he says are fake antiquities for which he paid hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, I want to wish you good luck with the book. When does it come out? Is it still a work in progress?
I got to finish. I got two more chapters left, but right, the stories keep rolling in. It's hard to choose.
All right. Well, good luck with the book. And I want to thank you for your time today. Thank you to Aaron Thompson, author and author of a future book as well, and art crime professor at the City University of New York. Thank you for joining us.
Wonderful to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk with the head of the special collections at Ohio State's Thompson Library. He's going to tell us about Ohio's unique connection to bookbreaking, which is the selling pieces of a rare book rather than keeping it together. And that is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Art theft is not just for big museums and cities. It has connections all over the world, including an interesting case here in Ohio. An Akron man whose actions are questionable in terms of legality, but he undeniably destroyed historical texts. Joining us now is Dr. Eric Johnson, a professor and the head of the Thompson Special Collections at the Ohio State University Libraries. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
So this Akron man, he was buying medieval manuscripts and then cutting pages out to resell them. Can you tell me about that?
Sure, yeah. So Mr. Farini was a pretty well-known medieval manuscripts and antiquity dealer, began his business in the later 1970s and really started to pick up speed in the 1980s. And he did not exclusively break apart manuscripts. I want to be very careful about that and clear. He sold intact manuscripts, but he would also try to identify with kind of a network of funders and business partners suitable manuscripts that he could buy at auction or from private collectors at what could be determined as like bargain prices, but would have a lot of upside potential for splitting into component individual leaves to sell off at greater profit.
So you can make more money selling individual pages sometimes than a whole book?
Correct. So I first got into investigating Farini and his activities when I started at Ohio State, and kind of I came here as my first title was curator of early books and manuscripts. My own background, I'm a medievalist. I work with medieval manuscripts, and OSU, it turns out, had a substantial collection of about 670 manuscript folios, and about 135 of those came from one single early 13th century illuminated Bible that I subsequently discovered Farini and his network had bought at auction in September 81, and then within a month had had it cut apart into individual pages and started marketing them. I've written a substantial article on this that was published back in 2019, but long story short on your answer to the profit margin is they spent just over $23,000 to buy that 13th century Bible. It consisted of 440 individual leaves. Within those 440 leaves, there were 71 historiated initials. What that means, like gold illuminated initials with depictions of St. Paul, other biblical mm-hmm. figures in them. So true works of medieval art. They wound up starting to market those pages at anywhere from a couple hundred bucks to $500 for pages that only had text on it. While pages that had illuminations of, for instance, St. Paul, they were listing at $6,500 per page. So we still don't know where every page of that manuscript are. It's been too widely dispersed around the world over the last 40 years or so. But I did this kind of computation based on appraised prices for, or appraised values for leaves that had been donated to Ohio State over the years, things that I've seen sell at auction or sell at retail. And roughly, if you were able to create like an Amazon.com shopping cart and put all 440 individual leaves into that cart, that $23,100 Bible, which is equivalent to about $60,000 today in 2025 money, would cost you just under $1 million to buy that book page by page.
Wow.
So
when you're saying leaves, you mean pages.
So in manuscript studies terms, a leaf consists of two pages, front and back. So those are called leaves or folios. And then when you're referring to a page, it means either the front of that leaf or folio or the back of it.
Okay.
So this Bible would have been 440 leaves or 880 pages.
Oh, I see. And so people who are buying them, are they buying them because they're collectors or because do they frame one page of a leaf and display it?
Yes. Yeah. So there are as many reasons to buy one of these or motivations as there are to collect anything. So some people will buy these because they're medievalists and they want a piece of medieval history to hang on to identify with. They are very useful in teaching scenarios. So a lot of universities, museums have had these and have collected these through the years, whether by purchase or donation, in order to serve as teaching examples. And that's indeed how OSU's collection really started back in the early 1980s. Other folks who do this. Farini is not the only person who broke manuscripts or even today continues to break manuscripts to sell. A lot of them will market, especially Bibles, as these relics of the Christian past. You too can own a piece of this historic Bible. So might not even be people who are interested in the Middle Ages. They just want something that's, say, 800 years old and represents text from, say, a famous Bible passage.
Now, what he did is not necessarily illegal, right?
No.
He owned the book, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there are no laws that prohibit owners, whether they're private owners or commercial owners, or indeed even institutions, from breaking apart their books. And in the world of manuscript fragmentation for commercial profit, that can actually go to absurd lengths. There have been some instances where a substantial fragment of an original medieval manuscript or a complete manuscript has been cut down into its constituent pages or leaves and then has been cut into lines or individual words. Because as the noted manuscript scholar Christopher de Hamel, who's over in the UK, he's based in the UK, as he has put it, it's like you have infinite profits when you start breaking books and manuscripts, because you can just keep cutting them smaller and smaller, but every last piece winds up being worth something to a collector somewhere.
Now I'm going to go out on a limb here and say you disagree with him.
Completely.
Okay.
Completely. Yes. The breaking of medieval...
You disagree with him tearing the books apart.
Oh,
not disagreeing with the other guy you quoted.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. So the justification for a lot of this on, say, aesthetics and artistic grounds is that breaking apart a Bible like the one that I've been working on has, like, that Bible, when you think about the illuminated initials that it had in it, had 71 individual, in modern terms, frameable pieces of art. If, say, a museum has that, it can only display one page opening at a time. You can't put the whole cycle on display. So there's a, you know, some collectors, some museums have justified the possession of these or the breaking of manuscripts because it makes the contents more accessible. The problem with this is, especially on the commercial side, once things start getting distributed, is you lose all historical context for what that object was. And a lot of the justifications we'll talk about, well, you know, this was just a Bible. We all know what the Bible is. There are thousands of copies of medieval Bibles everywhere. That is true. The problem is manuscripts by their very nature are unique objects. Everything about them was made by hand, from the individual animal skins that were cured and processed to create the pages, the inks and the pigments that were brewed and mixed by hand, the individual scribes that wrote the text and inserted errors, especially the correction practices, the damage practices over the centuries, people use them, they add their own notes to them, things like that. So every single manuscript is unique. And when Farini and people like him distribute these manuscripts, we lose the ability to tell the story of that particular book and how it has touched and impacted the lives of countless generations of users throughout history.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This hour, we're talking about art theft. And right now, we're talking about the history of some text and art pieces with Dr. Eric Johnson, a professor and the head of the Thompson Special Collections at The Ohio State University Libraries. So can you tell us how you became a lead curator here at Ohio State?
Sure, yeah. So I went to college and was an English major, and took a while to figure out what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Ultimately settled on being an English major with a focus in medieval studies. Hit my senior year and realized I had no idea really how I was going to translate that into the real world. And so the obvious next step, for me at any rate, was just kind of this reflexive approach to go to graduate school. So I went to graduate school, initially got a master's degree. That turned into pursuing a PhD in medieval studies. And I dutifully applied to every open position in the English-speaking world in my field and did not get any of those jobs. It's a brutal market. It's even more brutal today than it was back then. And I wound up, just by chance, backing into a special collections job at Princeton University, where I became a curatorial assistant in the rare books and manuscripts department there. And at that point, I realized that my student training as a grad student PhD candidate didn't just limit me to doing like teaching of English or teaching of history. There was an entire world to discover in the rare books end. So I started teaching across about 5,000 years worth of history based on the collections that were in my care at the first job, and doing things like exhibits, K through 12 outreach, general public outreach, university-based teaching, research of all types. And that really determined for me that I wanted to pursue a career in librarianship. So I did about 6 years at Princeton, a couple years contracting work for them. And then fearing I was going career obsolete during that contract position, as luck would have it, the job at Ohio State opened up and they were looking for someone, preferably who had library training and experience, which I did. I had gotten my library degree while I was working in my first job. So I was able to tick that box, but they also wanted someone who had academic expertise, ideally a master's degree or a PhD in medieval or pre-modern studies of some sort. So for me, it was like this holy grail position.
That was very specific,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's like, I'm going to go for that. Yeah. And it worked out.
So you work, can you tell us what goes into the process of curating artifacts to go into your library?
Yeah, so at Ohio State, we're lucky enough to have some secure lines of funding to in order to acquire certain things. So we have some centrally allocated funds as well as endowed funds that countless generous donors have given us that allow us to purchase across the whole field of intellectual and artistic creation in human history. So rare books collections go back 5,000 years to Babylon and then up to the present. We quite literally have things probably produced yesterday at this point. Mm-hmm. So there is a vast field of things to curate and to add to the collections. We also add via donation and working with collectors who donate materials to us directly that are related to our collection scopes. At the Rare Books and Manuscripts Library, and indeed across all of the special collections units at OSU, there's a very heavy emphasis to serving campus needs. So what are the research profiles of faculty? What are the curricular needs in terms of the teaching that's being done? And we try to really integrate collections into hands-on use with students. So those are some basic things that guide what we buy. But then within my realm in particular, when we're talking about medieval manuscripts, early printed books, antiquities, there's always this extra layer of care that needs to go in, one, to determine that things aren't counterfeit, and two, and more importantly, probably because it's really difficult actually to counterfeit these things, really importantly, to determine that you're buying things ethically or acquiring things via donation ethically. So that means determining the provenance chain of ownership, so the history of ownership, how far back can you trace it? Making sure in the instance of things like, say, broken books, that, you know, recognizing that books have been broken, medieval manuscripts have been broken to serve other purposes since, you know, the Middle Ages. This is not a new thing. So you have to get comfortable with this idea of where your ethical line is with buying fragments. So are you going to buy only fragments or accept donations of fragments that were fragmented 50 or more years ago, 10 or more years ago, 100 or more years ago? And you have to give a lot of deliberate thought to, you know, how you're going to justify this to yourself, to the scholarly community, the collecting community. So at OSU, we try to really focus on what I term licit or historical breakings. So things where, you know, books fall apart. As medieval manuscripts have fallen apart through the years from use or overuse, people have found ways to recycle those components, either as structural supports for later book bindings, insertion as forms for clothes and shoes, even in saddles and hats and things like that. So when you can find fragments that have been reused, you're eminently safe in terms of acquiring those. For things that were deliberately broken for commercial profit, I really emphasize trying to collect materials that Bruce Farini broke and distributed, one, because that activity is at least 20 to 30 years old, or another famous Ohio bookbreaker, which we won't get into here because it's, you know, endless episodes, a Cleveland-based guy named Otto Egge. He was an art educator who sold, he broke up possibly as many as 300 manuscripts between the 1920s and his death in 1951.
It sounds like you have a bookbreaker podcast in the works here.
At Ohio State, because Ohio as a state, I think quite literally can be called the home of American bookbreaking. And with my mentality has always been OSU has the biggest collection of this kind of material, definitely in the state, and one of the biggest in the entire country. So I personally feel as like the curator for this collection, it's part of my role and it's part of the university's role to try to undo a lot of this historic damage and then create the opportunity for scholars to research and reconstruct these manuscripts.
So what you have in your collection, do students come to look at it or can the public come look at it?
Entirely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So I would say the medieval manuscripts collection in general, but specifically the fragments, and we're at over 1,500 individual fragments from what would have been originally 540 different medieval manuscripts. It's a remarkably substantial collection. It's amongst the most used of all special collections, sub-collections across the entire university. Those kinds of materials have been deployed in curriculum and programming for more than 30 different academic units at Ohio State, all of the traditional arts and humanities kinds of things, but even courses related to cognitive science, chemistry, biology, mathematics, the hard sciences in general. So we're really getting them out there, and we encourage students to come in and use. We also are open. We're a land-grant institution. We're the university for the state. We like to consider we're a university in our strength areas, and we're a collection for the world as well and the region. So anyone can come in. And a great example of that is tomorrow we have a group of English students, undergraduates from Pikeville University in Kentucky, driving all the way up here to use our collections. And they will indeed be looking at manuscripts.
Wow. So. Can you tell by looking at something if the page had been cut out of a book or if the book fell apart naturally?
For the most part, yes, especially if it's modern stuff. I mean, it's it's pretty easy to see nice straight scissor or
an exacto knife
lines. But when you start getting into some of the older stuff, it can be a little bit difficult because these books were alive. You know, they gather different layers and patterns and signs of damage through time. And that's one of the things that you have to learn how to identify. That's a kind of a subfield or an ancillary field of what's called codicology, which is the study of the physical structure of a book and being able to read all of the material evidence that's preserved in pages or entire books in order to try to reconstruct its history of use and production.
And what you're talking about here, you have experience in fragmentology. So explain that. Explain that word.
So fragmentology is a subdiscipline of the big umbrella field manuscript studies. And what it is, it's a relatively new discipline. There have been people who have dedicated their lives to working on manuscript fragments for at least the last 100 to 150 years or so. But it's really emerged within the last 30 years as I think the most exciting and probably vibrant subfield of manuscript studies. And the main reason for that is because of the power of what digital technology allows us to do. So with something like the Bible that Farini broke in 1981, it has literally been dispersed all over the world. Prior to digitization and the ability to do things in the digital environment, it would have been impossible to reconstruct that manuscript. Ohio State, despite my best efforts, we will never own every leaf of that manuscript. Some things are...
Wait, you can have goals.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We're up to 197.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
We started at 135 when I was here, so we're doing well. But, you know, arguably the most valuable leaf, the opening leaf for the Book of Genesis with this dazzling full-page illumination on it, that's actually in an art museum in Tokyo. We're never getting our hands on that.
Mm. But so they bought it off of him?
I don't know if they bought it off of Farini, but they took it out. Mm-hmm. It was either donated or purchased out of a private collection. There's a very vibrant manuscript collecting community in Japan. So a lot of fragments have wound up over there. But through the power of digital technology, we're able to actually pull together images from libraries, museums, even private collectors who want to contribute things and post those, mount those online in various different kinds of environments, whether it's your own kind of blog site or more formal academic sites like this really great fragmentology dedicated project out of Switzerland called Fragmentarium. Their whole purpose is dedicated towards the reconstruction of broken medieval books.
Now, so these students you mentioned who are coming from Kentucky to look, they're going to look at the actual pages, but do you have them digitized too? Can people look at it online?
Yeah, so we're in the midst of digitizing all of the fragments. It's a long process to do. There's not just the actual imaging that has to happen, and that's I'm not an expert in that. I have colleagues who are brilliant at this at the library, but like there are challenges with medieval manuscripts, especially parchment manuscripts, which means manuscripts made on animal skin pages. Mm. Those are what are called exceptionally hydroscopic types of materials. So they're very moisture sensitive. So they ripple, they contour, they might move if you even have it out for 5 minutes. It may curl and things. So digitizers have to take account of those things and devise ways to photograph nicely. Also, when you're starting to lay pigment, say a medieval bookmaker, pigment, gold, silver, things like that on the pages, all of that creates difficulty on the lighting side of things for digitization. So a lot of work goes in on that side. And then there's the metadata side, the description side. And I do a ton of the identifications. I basically spent much of the pandemic researching our collections and identifying, you know, 1,000+ manuscript leaves, dating, localizing them, getting the text down, all of that stuff. So we've been doing all of that, and I don't have an exact figure for you, but we probably have... We're approaching about half of the fragment collection is now digitized and online via the university library's digital content system. All of that is available free for people to go in and look at. We're going to be adding more relatively soon. But we've also shared those images and all of the associated metadata with the Digital Public Library of America. I've partnered with a big digital humanities academic project, Digital Scriptorium, to get that material out that way because that's a bigger, like, international tool for disseminating these things. So, yeah, we're working on getting all the manuscripts digitized.
Well, this has been fascinating. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to say thank you. Thank you to Dr. Eric Johnson, a professor and the head of Thompson Special Collections at the Ohio State University Libraries. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.